man in a glass case of emotion.
Hey, welcome to Cinema Sessions, the podcast where two film fanatics who happen to also be therapists geek out about their favorite films, share therapeutic insights, character deep dives, and a healthy portion of non-clinical nonsense. My name is Rick Gutterson, and I am joined today by my wonderful co-host, Kayla Tuttle. How are you doing today?
I am fantastic, Rick.
That's good. I am glad that you are fantastic. I am feeling fantastic. I'm also feeling pretty fabulous today.
You are fabulous.
You challenged me to find a pink shirt.
Yes.
I did not have a pink shirt, but I found a pinkish scarf.
Uh-huh.
And then to overcompensate, I have turned all of the lights in my room here to a shade of pink, and I'm strangely okay with it.
You have a pink glow about you. That can be like your aura color.
Yes. What if that could follow me around? Like if I could just bring like this like shade of pink around, and it's kind of like, for those who are listening, it's kind of splashing on the one side of my face. I had like a two-face, like the Batman character, but half the side of my face was all pink.
Or what if it changed according to your mood? So you could be like a mood ring, but like, that'd be kind of hard in therapy though, because it'd be like your client could see exactly like what emotion you're feeling. So if they're like, you know, if they're just like really down in the dumps and depressed, and they're like not really doing what they're supposed to do to change their life, and you're just like getting so like you're just turning red, and they're just like, ah, I want to shake them.
Oh no, that would be horrible. They're like, sir, are you okay? Are you like having a stroke? No, you're not making the progress I want, and my skin is changing colors to reflect my unhappiness.
They're like walking you through your like regulation coping skills. They're helping you to kind of de-escalate.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Rick, practice the four square breathing technique.
Yes. Or grounding. What do you see?
Grounding.
What can you touch?
Do some visualization. Like, picture yourself outside in nature. What is there's a stream, some birds chirping.
Uh-huh.
Oh, thank you. And then my skin could turn like, would it turn green when I'm calm? Would it turn blue?
Because
blue feels calm, but it also feels sad.
Yeah, and maybe there's like, well, there'd probably be shade. So it'd probably be like how you're like when you're sliding a scale and you're like adjusting a color. So it'd probably like lessen and turn into more like if it's red, it just kind of goes down into pink, and then maybe it goes to like purple, and it's more like blue when you're like really relaxed.
I like it. What color, what emotion does pink represent?
Ooh, pink to me is like excited, flirty, maybe even like interested, like connected.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think this kind of summarizes it.
We need that good feminine energy.
We do.
I'm bringing my feminine energy today, because if you haven't picked up on the hints, we are covering the 2023 blockbuster smash hit Barbie. I never thought like those words would come out of my mouth. It's fascinating that this movie just crushed the box office. Like it's so crazy.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Ken. Hi, Barbie. Hi, Barbie. Hi, Ken. Well, before we jump into things here, I just want to say thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast. Like, it's so cool to think, like, you know, Kayla and I, and when Michael was on the show all the time, you're recording and you're doing these things, have these amazing conversations, and you kind of get lost in the conversation that, like, it's just cool to know that other people are listening and love movies the way we do. They love talking mental health. And we just wanted to say thank you for all of you who listen, who subscribe, and yeah, it's such an honor to know that on certain mornings we can be there and kind of be a part of your morning routine. It's really honoring when you actually think about it. It's really cool.
I know. It's like it's kind of similar to therapy too. It's like I feel like I'm accompanying people throughout their day.
Yeah, I feel bad for them sometimes that.
Yeah, I'm like people will be like, I've had clients be like, I was in this situation and I thought, what would Kayla do? And I'm like, well, I don't know if I would want, like, should I be the person on your shoulder that you're referencing? Right. Like, I don't know if I want that power.
Right. I just posted a picture right before we recorded of me with the pink hue on my skin from these lights and making a kissy face. And like, is this the face of a therapist that instills confidence in their clients? Or is this 100%. Some weirdo? Right. Well, thank you guys for listening and checking it out. I want to encourage you, if you haven't already subscribed or started following the show, you can follow us on Apple, Spotify, any of the other platforms. And especially with a movie like this that so many people have seen, we're going to cover some really unique and interesting themes. So we want to encourage you to, you know, share this podcast, send a text to a friend or a family member, someone that you know that loves movies, loves mental health, and that intersection between the two. Because I think sometimes having hard conversations can be much easier, and we can bridge that gap when you're doing it through a movie that we love or that we're interested. And I think that's a fun way to do it. You know, you can leave a review of this podcast. That helps the show out, help other people find it. And also you can follow us on Instagram. It's at Cinema Sessions Pod. Yeah, we were excited to jump into this movie. If you want to check out that Instagram page or the Facebook group, there's the links for those in the show descriptions before. So Barbie 2023. Oh my gosh. This is a phenomenon culturally. When's
the sneaky underground hit? You mean just really indie?
Yeah, it's a very indie, exactly. Only a couple of, it's basically right there with like that movie we covered, Tully.
You know? Yeah, like no one's really heard of it. It's like, oh, it's a good movie, but you really gotta, like, you need some word of mouth to get there. It's right, tough. Yeah.
I was still blown away with how well this movie did, and I started thinking about like other cultural phenomenon movies. And so I wanted to jump into what we like to call Rick's curious question.
Excuse me, I have a few more questions if you don't mind.
Taking Barbie out for a second, what's the last movie that you saw that you felt was like a cultural phenomenon that just had everyone in the community buzzing, or you just felt like you could just engage with the average person and you knew exactly what you're talking about because the movie was so popular?
That's a great question. The average person. I think that's what what's really
person.
Hard.
They don't have to be a hardcore movie person.
I feel like this was a while ago. But I want to say the last movie that I could widely talk about with everyone, and almost everyone had seen it, was Avengers Endgame.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, even if you weren't like, it got a lot of people into the Marvel universe. Like people watched it. I know some people that would watch it even, you know, like if they didn't see the other movies, but it was so high grossing and so like in the zeitgeist that a lot of people had seen it.
Yeah, it was. As a comic book fan, like it was so fun to like have conversations about like Thanos and the Infinity Gauntlet and the snap and all these things that I had read about in comic books as a child or as a young adult, and having those conversations with the average person on the street was just such a cool experience that I didn't really think I'd ever have that kind of experience, you know. Yeah, similar kind of to the Endgame, the one that came to my mind was a few years prior, was 2015, was when The Force Awakens came out.
Oh yeah.
And that just swept everything. And I'm more of a Marvel guy than a Star Wars guy. I love, you know, I really enjoy Star Wars, but I'm not as hardcore into that as this. But like I was there at 12:01 waiting in line waiting. I think we got there like 3 or 4 hours early. There was a company that had hired all of these kind of actors or character, you know, artists to come out, and they had an R2-D2 there. They had Stormtroopers, Darth Vader. And I just remember being all excited about getting my photo taken with Darth Vader. It had this like Comic-Con vibe outside of this small little theater, and just the excitement level of the anticipation of walking around the mall waiting. It reminded me of high school. And then just after the fact, asking people like, what did you think about Rey and Finn and, you know, Han Solo and just all of that stuff. And just, you could just talk about it so casually with anybody that you came in contact with. It was amazing.
Yeah. It's funny, like with therapy, like I kind of like Barbie is how I like how this is kind of like how I realized, I mean, I knew it was a smash hit, like who didn't, but like when clients were bringing, like every other client was bringing it up and saying, have you seen the Barbie movie? That reminded me of the Barbie movie. I'm like, oh my, like how mainstream and applicable this film is for so many people.
Yeah. Yeah. I had someone text message me the other day and now I, or messaged me online the other day and now I know exactly what that meant.
Sublime!
Sublime, the 90s band? No, I know. No, it's just Ryan Gosling screaming his heart's desire. So good. Well, I it's interesting watching this movie. Before I give my thoughts on it, just for those, you know, a lot of people have seen this film, but for those who haven't or need a quick refresher, could you give us a simple synopsis of Barbie?
Yeah, so this movie centers on none other than Barbie as our main character, and she lives in this dream world that's kind of like we're going into the Barbie house, the Barbie land of all the toys that so many of us played with when we were younger. And it's just like this picture perfect world, like perfectly manicured, perfectly feels like it was like made for social media in these times. Just everything's beautiful and wonderful and everyone's happy and there's always, you know, enough of everything and everyone feels great and groovy all the time. And same with the men. The men kind of live like away from the Barbies, the Kens, but they also are just like masculine and loving life and like there's just like these perfect pairings and everyone has their own little place in their own little world. And then Barbie starts to have some malfunctions and she's starting to make some comments and have some odd things happen and kind of get a sense of reality testing in a way of, is this environment actually all that is out there? So this is really Barbie's adventure as she's thrown into real life to see what is beyond the walls of Barbie land.
I like the word malfunction. That is a perfect way to describe it.
This is the lowest I've ever been emotionally and physically.
I bust out laughing when I saw that scene. She's just laying, like, essentially planking on the ground, perfectly still, face embedded into the grass. It was, oh, it was so good. So let me start with this question for you, Caleb. Why do you think this movie was such a cultural phenomenon?
I think there's a few reasons. I think, one, it takes this childhood toy that's been around for decades and decades, and it gives it kind of like a repurposing of, like, I love so much that Mattel was part of this movie, because, like, you might almost be like, oh, Mattel would have a huge problem with this movie because they're so apt to point out, like, where they've gone wrong in creating Barbie. Because we'll talk about it, but obviously unrealistic body type, unrealistic beauty standards, genderizing. I don't know. It's like
tenderizing, but genderizing.
Genders. Like smashing you into the gender that you need to be. Why it's not genderizing? Term. Let's go with it. I like it. But I think also, I mean, for men and women, I'm going to speak more so to women because I'm a woman. But like, I think I just pointed out in a funny way that was really approachable of so many of these things that we go through, but in this package that was really that you're able to approach and kind of talk about. And this, it's very vulnerable questions that this movie wrestles with, but it's like presented in such a funny format, and it has, you know, like a great cast and great music and all these things, and Greta Gerwig, who's amazing, behind it with the writing and the directing and everything. But it made it so approachable of this thing that I think has had such like a torrid history back and forth of, like, Barbie's been loved and Barbie's been hated over the years. And this kind of like spoke to both ends of, like, I understand why people loved it and I understand why people hated it, and everywhere in between.
And that's the thing that is fascinating about the concept of making a Barbie movie, is like with Avengers Endgame or any of the Avengers movies early on, it's like taking this property that's loved and then bringing it onto screen. But Barbie is, and you can say that with anything like Star Wars or, you know, any of these other big IP characters. But Barbie, there's such a tumultuous, like, it has a lot of meaning to the word Barbie, and it's not all positive. And I think it's cool that the movie didn't shy away from that.
Mm-hmm.
That it dove into, like, hey, let's talk about, like, the teenage character, Sasha, says that she set women back 50 years when she first meets, you know, Margot Robbie as Barbie. And that's really interesting. That's a fascinating concept for a movie that's not just like, hey, Barbie, let's go. But it also, like, goes, there's some messiness to this topic, and to approach it in a lighthearted way, because you can have this theme, put it in a drama, and, you know, make, you know, $30 million box office worldwide. And okay, it's a successful movie. But like, this is going to have a culture impact, to have conversations that spread far more because of the unique, quirky nature of the film, and the comedic aspect of it allows the average person to be interested. Like, I had no desire to see this movie until I saw the feedback and all of the things, and I went, huh, this is really interesting. And then it's hard to get to the theaters when you have a four-year-old, but I finally did get to watch it. Side note for a second, Kayla, we couldn't get to catch it in theaters. I know it's still playing here and there, but Cheryl had said that she wanted to watch it, and I was like, well, I finally looked online and it was, you know, available to rent or purchase at home. And it's, you know, similar to buying two tickets. So I was like, all right, I guess we rent it for $25, or you could buy it for $30. I'm like, well, for $5 more. So now I am the proud owner of a digital copy of the movie Barbie at home. Things I would never thought I would experience in my life.
You own a piece of Barbie merchandise.
I do. I own something Barbie related, and I'm slightly proud of it. I really enjoyed this movie, and I did not think I would.
Yeah.
So I also have to, she'll hate that I bring this up, but my wife did not have the same love of this film.
Oh, really?
And it wasn't because of the messages. The messages are fine. She doesn't like weird movies. And she just goes,
it is a weird movie.
And she goes, this is weird. I don't like it.
It's very self-aware. There's a lot of meta-ness to it. It's
Yeah. She started off really liking it. And I think the big defining scene for her that made her not like it was the same one that really solidified how much I loved it, which was the Ken battle.
Yes.
I love that scene. I just looked over. I was like, I think she's rolling her eyes every 3 seconds. I better make sure she's not actually having some type of like medical incident.
Does she not really like musical theater stuff?
She does, but I think the serious versions are like she would listen to the Sound of Music or anything like that. So this I think the meta weirdness to it was like I could just see her going, oh God. So that was when it solidified, because at first I'm like, I'm not sure how I feel about this. And then Men on Horses happens, and maybe one of my favorite lines in all of film history.
I'll play the guitar at you.
Oh, yay!
Everyone's playing the exact same chords
and at you.
I'll play the guitar at you. And then, and of all things, a song that I remembered from my high school days, Push by Matchbox 20.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was some controversy around like that she chose that song too. I didn't know the story behind that song, but there were some people like, I can't believe you used this like abusive song towards women. And then like the lead singer was like, actually, this is about how a woman abused me, like, like, you know, taking advantage of me or whatever. And so, like, she chose it for a very specific reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you hear the lyrics. That was the first time I really considered it. I'm like, wait, is this song about men abusing women? And I did the same thing. Like, I didn't think it was. And sure enough, it's like, no. And they also had said, like, there was a metaphor potentially for kind of a bad band breakup. From his first band into Matchbox 20. And so there was, like, wondering if there was some crossover of like feeling abused by his former band. I was like, wow, this is really, really interesting. But just seeing all these dudes power strumming this guitar, I'm just like, I feel like I've experienced this in life when I first got my guitar. Let me play my guitar at you. Just sit here.
And the women are just dazed. They're just like, this is all I've ever wanted out of life.
Right. And I think the best part was that little side note, 4 hours later, and they're still playing the same song. Oh, it's so good. I love that part so much. What are some of the parts that, like, when you reflect on seeing this movie, like, that just jump out to you as, like, either the most humorous or the parts that just really struck you the most?
There's a lot. So definitely when she's on the dance floor early on, she goes, do you guys ever think about dying? I have never, like, that is, like, I resonated with that so much because I've talked a lot with Rick about it, and I've talked on here before. I'm like, I used to be in this, like, cheerleader kind of Barbie crowd, and then, like, I would have all these, you know, depth of layers of thought, and if I would express anything like that, it was like, what? Like, you're a cheerleader. And, right. Like, it's like, oh, I'll just keep dancing and, you know, doing the thing.
Yeah. Oh, never mind.
And never mind. I'm not going to express anything ever again.
Exactly.
Obviously, the America Ferrera scene is like just historical. Yeah. Like, that scene alone, like, if no one else saw the rest of this movie, just watching that scene, I think that'll be used in women's and gender studies, like, from here on out, because it just really concisely points out the paradoxical nature of being a woman.
We'll touch more on that later, too, because that scene needs a lot of unpacking and just discussion. I got goosebumps listening to that part.
Yeah, and I just love the silliness of, like, Will Ferrell's boardroom and how it's a boardroom designed to make decisions about, like, women and girls and who they're gonna, like, what they're gonna play with and, like, all the brands and stuff. And there's not a single woman in the office, and they're just like, here's what women and girls want. It's so, like, it laughs at itself, and I love it.
We had a woman once, and he knows a woman. Oh, that was great. That was really funny. I thought about I think my favorite parts were just a lot of the Ken things too. I think early on in the movie, I think it's right after the big dance thing, and he's trying to get her attention, and he's trying to make his move, and he just shoots his shot, and he goes in for the kiss, and she just stares at him all nice, and she's like, "Okay, you can go now." He's like, oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I was like, that hits home my high school self so hard.
Aww.
Oh, it was so good. I think the other thing I loved was Weird Barbie.
I love Weird Barbie.
I didn't know
she's amazing.
Kate McKinnon was going to be in this. And sometimes she's amazing in roles. Sometimes it's a little bit over the top. This was perfect. Like, one of my favorite like perfect roles for her. It was so good. Like, I didn't obviously, I shouldn't say obviously because some people did, but I didn't have any Barbie dolls. But I remember having like a couple of my cousins had them. And I just remember going to people's places who had sisters or they just had them around or whatever and having like the Barbie with the mangled hair or things mm-hmm. drawn over it. And to have that embodied on the screen was so cool.
And it's funny because I think, I don't know, for me at least, like I feel like Weird Barbie is the one that I relate to most out of the cast of characters.
Do you stand around and just randomly do the splits or lean against the wall?
And then I put marker all over my face. And then I have weird maps that come out of odd directions in my office.
I could strangely picture that, actually.
I wouldn't put it past me.
I like it. And then when I think about my favorite actual scene, I laughed out loud numerous times when I seen that. I don't know what to call it other than like Ken's montage of manliness when he's just like
the horses and
he shows up in the new world. He's like, wait, like men aren't submissive in this world, like men are in charge. And he sees like the cops on the horses. He sees the shots of Rocky. He's like, the woman asks him what time it is. And he just, his chest puffs up. And he feels so manly. Like, and then he's just smiling and smiling. I was in tears watching that part. I was like, that was so good. And then of course, then he goes back and brings this newfound information about trucks and the patriarchy to his people.
At first I thought the real world was run by men. And then there was a minute where I thought it was run by horses. But then I realized that horses are just men extenders.
Oh. Horses are men extenders. How do you feel about that? Is that real?
I think you have to speak to that, Rick. I don't know.
Well, I've never had the urge to ride a horse, but after watching this, I feel like it's part of my my training into manhood. Like I've missed out on something. Like I haven't fully been initiated. I don't read magazines on trucks and I don't ride horses. And I feel kind of inferior now and I need to change that. And now I also need to joust on the beach with other men in a fight for supremacy.
I thought that's what you guys just did. I thought that was like how men think women just get together in circles and talk and learn all this stuff. I thought that's what men do.
Well, you know, we work on it. You know, a lot of grunting, a lot of, I mean, it's not, the thing that was missing was watching football. If they incorporated that aspect of it, then it's like it's hitting all the pieces.
Yeah. And then you got to get hurt. And then another one's like, toughen up, rub some dirt in it. You'll be shake it off. Yeah.
So there's so many other comedic things that I'm sure we'll hit on through talking about some of these other elements. But I wanted to kind of like transition into the therapeutic themes of this film. And, you know, Kayla, we've talked on a few different previous episodes how qualified and informed I am to speak on issues regarding women, right? We talked about birthing and motherhood and Leia's femininity. And I don't want to completely overshadow you, but I am one of the world's leading experts on all things femininity. So just kind of sit shotgun on this one and I'll just kind of power us through to the homeland on that.
Yeah. I'll just kind of be like your hype person. And I'll just kind of like second everything you say.
Sounds good, right? Everyone just shut off their phones. Like, this dude's nuts. I'm done. I don't have time for this. So, Kayla, I asked you what themes you thought about when watching this movie. And the very first thing you said was just, you know, feminism and kind of the struggles of being a woman, right? Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, you know, the word feminism has a very wide range of interpretations and meanings. A lot of them are super positive, and then some of them have been kind of skewed negative or at least kind of divisive. So how would you define that word, or what's a way that the average person can really understand that word through the lens of this conversation?
Yeah, it's just about equality. That's what it's chalked down to. So like seeing men and women as equal and as both capable of, you know, it's very empowering. It's a very humanistic take on culture and gender and, that women can do anything that men can do and men can do anything that women can do and all the genders in between. I think it's been divisive over time and I don't think that's by accident. I don't want to get on like a stop the patriarchy soapbox, but this movie does it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think it's like it's been used as a divisive term by men and women to lessen the cause of feminism, because it's like, I think some people have the wrong idea of this is like women hating men or women mm-hmm. don't need men. And I personally don't be, I don't think that that's the large part of people that would consider themselves feminist. It's the opposite. It's like, mm-hmm. how do we all live together in harmony and have equal power and control over the world that we're building around us? Not that one needs to be elevated above the other one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You used the word equality early on. And I think sometimes on my side of things, I've heard it. I think where I've seen it start to cross into like confusion or divisiveness is when it goes from being equal to being the same,
mm-hmm.
right? Where trying to blur the lines of like, okay, so, and this is where the conversation gets tricky. Now, I guess I should preface this by saying I'm trying to approach this conversation in a form of curiosity, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm a man. I mansplain things, right? Just like they show in this movie. So I want to kind of approach this with curiosity. And no matter where, you know, what your beliefs are or opinions are as you're listening to this conversation, I want to encourage you the same way. Like, we want to seek out to learn and to understand, but also then vice versa, you know, like, not even just in this topic, in every single topic we've ever covered, I'm inevitably going to say something weird or dumb accidentally or whatever. And so also asking for some grace from our listeners or whatever, as we're kind of mm-hmm. really having an important conversation, but approaching it in the sense of this curiosity and extending grace as we're all trying to understand each other better. When you have a topic that sometimes can be divisive or as split across a line, like a gender thing, right?
Yeah, that, and also I'll say feminism is such a loaded word. I mean, it's like, same how like liberal or religious, like mm-hmm. that can get like, there's so many different contexts and shadings to that of like, depending who you are and what that means to you culturally, politically, socially, all of that, that I am speaking to my brand of feminism, mm-hmm. how I understand it and how I interpret it and how I enact it in my life. But like, I have friends that consider themselves feminists in my life that would have very different ideals about certain issues than I do. And we both consider ourselves feminists. So mm-hmm. I can only speak to like my personal narrative of feminism.
I'm glad that you said that too, because the power that comes from being female is different from the power that comes from being male, right? There's a physical strength mm-hmm. often to a man that the average person, you know, the average female in size or stature is going to be different. But I think vice versa, women are incredibly strong. Sometimes it's physical strength, right? My wife, she's kicked a lot of butts in her days. She used to teach kickboxing and, you know, like, I'm like, I think I'm genuinely afraid of her right now, right? But then there's this like this inner core strength, man. I admire women so much in this, the strength that it takes, that this movie highlights of like, mm-hmm. man, you guys just put up with more crap than guys have to put up with. And yet you still show up, yet you still, yeah. And I think the movie highlights that. And there's an amazing strength to that, that the average man doesn't necessarily have to carry. And men have their own struggles and their own burdens that we have to carry. But mm-hmm. this movie highlights a lot of that strength that a woman has to be in, that tension of being this, yet also being this other thing, and both being right. The other thing that came to mind when you were saying that I thought about was like, feminist doesn't have to equal one specific trait of things, right? So mm-hmm. if it's about equality with women and empowering women, a woman who wants to be a stay-at-home mom and wants to dedicate her life to training up her next generation of family and investing in that is doing so by a choice, by strength. And that's yeah. her choice. And I've heard you say that in previous episodes. The key to mm-hmm. all of this is having choices, right? Yep. When choice is taken away from a woman, that's where you start to talk about the inequality and the balance and the you know.
And same with men too. Like yeah. saying like a man can't be a stay-at-home parent, like, That's problematic to me too. Like, I don't think anyone should be genderized
right.
into their gender to like have specific roles that they have to play out.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I didn't even think about that, even though that's a big part of my life. I mean, we've talked about this on a few different episodes in the past, but you know, the choice to become a stay-at-home dad for 18 months was a hard choice for both of our, you know, my wife and I, and it was hard to figure out what to do. And then also there was also struggles with once I was at home, it's like, man, It's strange to try to contact other people with kids because almost all of them at home were women, and it felt mm-hmm. it was a very isolating situation, and it wasn't anything that anyone did to me, but it was a struggle to feel like I could belong in that world. And mm-hmm. and I still get this to this day. Sometimes people will talk about like, you know, moms and women at home and this and that, and I'll joke about it sometimes. I'm like, you know, and like, oh yeah, you too, Rick, you know, and I'm like, it doesn't bother me in the sense of like, it hurts me at my core, but it's insight into my world as a man of like what the average woman might feel like in some of these other kind of stereotypical situations that are legitimate. Like, I've heard from so many women who struggle taking their cars to get oil changes or work on mechanic mm-hmm. stuff because they automatically get devalued as a woman and sometimes mm-hmm. taken advantage of financially because they don't know what they're doing or whatever. And it's sad and it's unfortunate.
Yeah. It's like when anyone has to be uncomfortable enacting a role that's not like consistent traditionally with their gender, like that's where I have issues. Like, for instance, one of the things that really like bothers me, and I hear it in commercials and media and even just like anecdotally, people say is, oh, dad's babysitting tonight. Mm. And I'm like, that's just so problematic for so many reasons, because they're not short-term caregiver. They're their parent. Like they're watching them and nurturing them, and hopefully in the same or equal ways that a mom would or another parent or caregiver would. Like it makes me sad on both ends of that, because then none of us can win, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're not going to be 100% like ascribing to our gender all the time. And if that's the checkbox that we're looking to mark, then who's going to reach that bar?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And does that mean that, because this is the thing I've been thinking about more since becoming a father, and is that like we attribute certain things to a gender, mm-hmm. but some of them are very specific to a skill set, right? As a male therapist that works in grief, I'm in a very small demographic, and I'm mm-hmm. used to that now, but originally it was weird. Like I was the only male in my social work program. And then in grad school, I was only one of a couple guys, and it was a very kind of isolating situation. Right. And it was just these assumptions that came out, and I'm like, well, I'm not someone that you're describing me like as. I'm different from this stereotype that you're describing as. Mm-hmm. Have you been in those positions before? And if you wouldn't mind sharing, like what are some times where you've been kind of pigeonholed or put into a box, maybe based on your gender?
Yeah, I think anything. Yeah, I personally, if I can avoid it, like I try to not go to a mechanic or mm-hmm. anything like that. Cause like I've been in those situations that are like, they'll just try to upsell you on a lot of things. And I personally don't have a lot of car knowledge. So I feel so uncomfortable to be in those positions. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't like having to like fake your way out of something or to pretend to be something that you're not, but like also have roles or like certain skill sets put on you that you have to be this thing in order to be in this category.
Yeah, that is a really that the movie highlights that quite a bit in the, well, you're a woman, so you have to do it this way or you have to mm-hmm. be this way. Do you feel that pressure a lot as a woman? I mean, do you feel like you have to, whether it's in a professional environment or even in your personal life, do you feel like there's a an expectation of here's how a woman has to act or behave?
Yeah, I'm actually encountering quite a bit of that right now because as we shared on one of our last episodes, I'm pregnant, so I haven't even had my baby yet. Yeah. He's due in January. But
I'm so happy for you, by the way.
I'm so excited. Like, I'm so excited to be a mom. And I also recently came into a leadership position at my work, so got great career. You know, I'm kind of settling into some home life stuff with being pregnant. And I already have moms and women asking me, well, how much time are you going to take off? And that feels like such a loaded question to me because I don't know that I could satisfy everyone with my answer, because some people are going to be like, well, you got to stay home longer for the baby, or no, you need to get back to work because you're in a position of power. Like mm-hmm. there is no winning in that scenario.
Yeah. Man, that's a hard teeter totter. I mean, mm-hmm. okay. So I just recently got promoted. You know, I'm thinking about your situation. You just recently got promoted and are stepping into this new role where you get to like impact a lot of lives on a macro level, leading this clinic. And then you also have this amazing new role that you're developing as a mom. And in some of those cases, the time and the energy is competing. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's a really legit challenge that everyone who's listening, who has either already been a parent or specifically a mom, has to have to wrestle with, because the average guy comes home, spends some time with the baby, and then goes back to work. You know, they might mm-hmm. get a couple weeks off. My brother actually got 3 months off, which was amazing. He lives in a different state. We, you know, you and I, we both live in Michigan, has different laws, but he lives in New York and they have very different rules there. He's able to mm-hmm. take some time off, which is great. But the average guy doesn't often get that luxury in the United States. And then it puts a lot of pressure on the mom. Well, am I the one that needs to leave my career? Mm-hmm. How do we navigate this? Right. So I know this is a personal discussion for you and Calvin right now, but how are those conversations for you guys? Is there, you know, 'cause you're in a very unique position.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, a lot of it's just based in, like, logic of what we have available. Yeah. Like, so for instance, I don't get maternity leave and my husband gets 6 weeks of paternity leave. So he may actually end up being more of the parent caregiver. Like, you know, I'll take my amount of time I'm going to take off work completely, you know, just for logistical reasons and bonding.
Yeah,
and
there's
all
some
that
logistics
fun
there,
stuff.
You know. I've heard these rumors.
Yeah, you know, imagine that. But then, like, he might be the person that's staying home more often or, like, more of, like, the primary caregiver in some aspects. So we are very, I think in most regards, we do a really good job of, like, egalitarian, like, companionship where it's very equal of how we divide things. And so I don't, obviously, I'm not, like, naive enough to think that, oh, parenting is just going to be this beautiful balance of power and energy and all these things. But I know there will be things that we work out, but we're such a good team in how we communicate on those things that I think we'll be able to figure that out.
Yeah. I think you put it well. And you know, we had to wrestle with the same things, like the logistics of, you know, my wife made more money and had insurance. Mm-hmm. I worked at the nonprofit, so I didn't make as much. And I had to work longer hours and evenings, even though I was thriving in my career and I was enjoying that and everything. It didn't make any sense on paper other than to protect my ego for me to continue to work and her to step back, because it would have been, we couldn't have afforded to live on just my salary alone as parents. And we could scrape by on just her salary alone, plus having the insurance. And so I had to make that hard decision. And it was a struggle because there's all these identity changes and all these things, and there's all this pressure. And I value that time so much because I gained insight that I wouldn't have had otherwise. Especially now as a therapist that I can have, like, I've had a lot of, like, new or expecting moms that I've worked with, and they're really shocked when I can speak to some of these things that, you know, are still different because it's through the male lens, but, like, oh, he actually does get what that identity shift is like, stepping back from your career and being a stay at home parent and feeling like you don't have an identity sometimes and walking around all day covered in a shirt with spit up all over it. And not to scare you totally away, of course, but, you know,
it sounds so fun.
Yeah, you're like, I love parenting. Side note for a second. Like, I know this is a parenting movie, but I realized that even in what I do, it's so important to share the balance of, like, the joys, because it's so easy because they're so stressful to share the horror stories and the struggles. But I was talking to another parent the other day and just going, like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. And it's also by far the most rewarding thing. It's given me the most life and the most purpose. And in order to have that, it comes with the struggles and the hardships that you experience. The hardships are a little more front loaded early on because you just don't sleep at all. But it is the coolest thing. And I'm so glad that I get to enjoy that gift of parenthood. But it comes at such a great sacrifice. It's so important to, like, share both sides, especially for new or expecting moms or dads, you know. So that's the one thing I wish they covered it briefly with. I can't believe that was a real Barbie, the Barbie who was expecting and had the baby inside
of her. I'm
thinking
about being her for Halloween, pregnant Barbie.
Oh, really?
Midge.
I love that. So we covered quite a bit of stuff with the struggles of femininity and everything. I was going to ask, like, what are some of the struggles of being a woman that are maybe we don't often think about, but I think we can do that under the kind of the next theme that we brought up that you mentioned, which is just body image. This movie does a great job of highlighting the struggles that Barbie did create in the expectations of body image. So, like, what came to your mind when they started to really bring that theme up in this film?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons I love the movie so much, because I had a lot of almost hatred, I want to say, towards Barbie and, like, what she represented. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, there was, like, legitimately a woman who, like, aimed to be like Barbie and had several plastic surgeries to be, like, the perfect ideal woman. And it just, that she represented this perfect, you can have it all. Like, that standard made it so hard that any flaw that you have fell short of that. Mm-hmm. And that mindset of, well, if I can't be like Barbie and that's the golden standard, like, either why even try, or I'm going to spend all my energy and effort to try to be like her.
Yeah, I can imagine that being very enslaving almost.
Yeah. And I think most women would probably agree, and men, because there's unrealistic body standards for men too, but just in a different context. But, like, the ideal woman, and I think we see this, like, in the modeling industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, anecdotally, I used to do some modeling when I was a teenager.
I didn't know that.
I was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Rick's always, like, learning things about kids.
It makes me so happy when I learn these new things. Like, basketball star and model and cheerleader and video game extraordinaire. Like, there's just this whole layered cake that's going on.
I'm like Barbie. I can have it all, Rick.
Well, I guess that makes me Ken. I don't know what that says, but
you are Knuff, Rick.
I am Knuff. Thank you.
I just
want
to say
I needed to hear that today.
No, but I was like, oh, I'm going to give this modeling thing a shot. And I went to go meet with modeling agencies and they were like, we love your profile and stuff, but you're too big. Like they told me, like,
gosh.
Basically I was too fat at the time. And I mean, this was like, we're talking, I was like a size 4 when I was a teenager, probably weighed, you know, like a little over 100 pounds. And they were like, you're not, as a teenager, like, this is not what we're looking for. And just, I felt proud. Like I was soul crushed, of course, because I was like, oh, here's this dream that might pan out, you know. I really valued that industry at the time. But I was like, I walked away from it so much because I was like, ooh, like, if this is the standard that they're going for, I don't know that I want to be a part of that culture of like this unrealistic as a teenager, when I don't think teenagers should be dieting to fit into a size by any means. But to try to fit this unrealistic beauty standard and then to go out and be a role model, because I also knew I wanted to do, you know, social change stuff and work with people and heal people and all that stuff. Like, I can't do both of those things if I'm living this really unrealistic identity.
Wow. Yeah, I that is something that I mean, I'm sure there are some professions, but men don't have to deal with that world. I would say, like, the only thing I can think of is like physical athletics. Like, if you're just not tall enough or not strong enough or not fast enough in certain positions, like, there's these physical components to things that are for the most part out of your control. But that's, I'm just processing it in real time as you said that, because that, you know, I've heard those stories, but I don't often hear those things from people I know personally. And it's heartbreaking to hear that that's a message that you've heard. And imagine there's a lot of listeners that have heard that message as well.
Yeah, I think that's the, and I would be like the first person to get up on a soapbox for men too, because there's so many unrealistic standards around masculinity and men too. But obviously I'm not speaking from a male perspective, but like, I think that's where like the emotional exhaustion comes in, of just all these little dynamics at play of like, I mean, I could not do a better job than just like to play America Ferrera's clip in this thing, but just to be like picture perfect and people pleasing all the time. Like, everyone has to be happy around you. You have to be beautiful. You also have to be successful and like crushing the glass ceiling. And it's just like, you can't be all of those things all of the time. No one can.
Yeah. You know, I pulled up the quote. It was way too long to actually get the audio clip of it, but I remember watching that part and getting goosebumps. And I just pulled the first audio part of it.
It is literally impossible to be a woman.
And I love how they introduce that scene, because, you know, Margot Robbie is just soul crushed and she's just sobbing and sobbing. And it's funny how they even made light of that. Like, we might have chose the wrong actress to portray someone not feeling pretty, but we're going to run with it anyways. But so let me just kind of, I'll read the quote as best I can. And I'm reading it because, you know, men, we're supposed to mansplain everything. But no, actually, I like reading the text of this because it's eye-opening to me to go like, this is the internal dialogue that women every day are walking around with. So it says, it is literally impossible to be a woman. You are so beautiful and so smart, and it kills me that you don't think you're good enough. Like, we have to always be extraordinary, but somehow we're always doing it wrong. You have to be thin, but not too thin. And you can never say you want to be thin. You have to say you want to be healthy, but you have to also still be thin. You have to have money, but you can't ask for money because that's crass. You have to be a boss, but you can't be mean. You have to lead, but you can't squash other people's ideas. You're supposed to love being a mother, but don't talk about your kids all damn time. You have to be a career woman, but also always be looking out for other people. You have to answer for men's bad behavior, which is insane. But if you point that out, you're accused of complaining. You're supposed to stay pretty for men, but not so pretty that you tempt them too much or you threaten other women because you're supposed to be part of the sisterhood. Let me pause there for a second. I've heard people talk about that. And growing up in the kind of the church world that I grew up in, like, that was a big thing of like, you know, don't cause your brother to stumble. But that's like a really, like, what, how do I know what that means? And why is that my responsibility? Like, have you experienced that, either people talking to that or just that internal dialogue of like, I have to look pretty, but not too pretty.
Oh, yeah, because you're perceived as threatening. Like, I, Yeah, like when I talk about this stuff, about like why this exists, like and I'm just speaking anecdotally here again and from what I see and experience, but I think the large part of this, of what's been created, it's not necessarily men that are crushing down on women. It's women crushing down other women because because we all feel so insecure about everything all the time that we need someone lesser than us that we can have a leg up on. So you're prettier than me. Well, I'm more this, and pretty is bad. And now fat is bad or skinny is bad. And like we ascribe all these different meanings to all these different things. And like as a culture, we just go, you know, back and forth. Like it's dizzying to keep up of like, what's the new hot, what should my body look like? What should my makeup be like? What, like, how do I need to be perceived in order to be successful? And, but also, you know, regarded as like a loving, caring person.
I've seen that before. I've liked it. And they talk about this in a movie, like women destroying other women. And, you know, I've talked to my wife about some of these things before where it's like, yeah, I'm not concerned about what the guys think about me. I'm more concerned about the women. Like even in like picking your outfit choices, it's not to please or displease or push away. It's all about what are other women going to perceive me as? And that's, again, that's another thing that like we might have to deal with it in other ways, like work related. There's a lot of comparison in our work as men, but in our general appearance, guys aren't judging each other in that way. I mean, that as you're telling me that, like, I feel exhausted for you and I'm not the one experiencing that.
Yeah, it's like so much. I feel like both genders this can happen. But like, I feel like women are so much like perceived by how they present. And if anything is off, it's like we have a lot to say about that. Like, oh, she's a awful person, or she doesn't take care of herself, or oh, her life's falling apart. Or like, I think most women have probably had the experience of like you show up to work and people are like, are you okay? Like, because you didn't do your makeup that day, or your hair's not right, or your butt. Like, and I don't think people mean it like they're not trying to be mean by any reason. It's just like we have this idea of this is like the box that we're supposed to fit into. And when someone's outside of that, I think they come from probably like a nice place. Like they're trying to be helpful and say, are you okay? Because you look off. But it's like, oh, like, you know, they're perceiving some, they're perceiving part of my identity of like what I'm experiencing based on my appearance. And I don't think men experience that as much as women do.
Yeah. I mean, men, it's definitely for the most part, a career or what you do with your hands kind of thing. There's an insecurity when someone isn't handy or isn't capable with automotives or can't talk business shop like other guys, can't talk finances, or even just like, okay, so what career path are you on? And, you know, like how much money are you bringing home? And you know, those kinds of things. And if you can't measure up in that way, it's fair that way. And it, the thing I can't speak to, because I am a big guy, is I do know that there are lots of people who struggle with the insecurity of like men are supposed to be the bigger physically gender, right? And so when you have a guy who's smaller in stature or isn't as physically strong or something like that, there's a lot of insecurity in those kinds of things. Again, these are very much broad generalizations, but I've talked to people that experience those things, and they have like these stereotypes of like the, you know, the short guy syndrome or, you know, Napoleon syndrome or things like that. But yeah, so I think that, but it's not nearly as visual as it is for women, right? You know, I was thinking about, well, let me finish reading this quote for those who haven't seen the movie yet or just want a refresher. So it says, but always stand out and always be grateful, but never forget the system is rigged. And that reminds me of like the boardroom when you talk about, you know, having women stay in the box. So, like, they literally, Will Ferrell tries to literally put Barbie right back into a box and tie her arms down. She finally realizes it and breaks out and runs away. I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, so the system is rigged. So find a way to acknowledge that, but also to be grateful. You have to never get old, never rude, never show off, never be selfish, never fall down, never fail, never show fear, never get out of line. It's too hard. It's too contradictory and nobody gives you a medal or says thank you. And it turns out, in fact, that not only are you doing everything wrong, but also everything is your fault. Man, that is an exhausting internal dialogue. And I think I've known that on the surface level. But when I heard that in the movie, I think this is one of those movies that I'll remember for helping me change the way I see the world and helping me change the way I think. To acknowledge things that I've heard, but I felt them in watching this movie. And I think that's one of the purposes of a movie, is to help you have the emotional experience of something, whether it's just something like entertainment or something like this that does both make you laugh and make you think.
Yeah, I think the like it's my fault thing. It's like, it's my fault and I'm not enough, or like the core beliefs that kind of come to mind of like this really unrealistic idea of womanhood and femininity and all this. And it's like, I think that's the struggle with Barbie over the years, is like, she kind of created this picture perfect view of, if you don't feel like enough, here's how you could be enough. Mm. Like, but it was such a high standard and there was no like mile marker in between. And it's like, well, I, you know, I'm doing all these things and I'm successful and like, I think I'm pretty or whatever, or people think I'm nice, but it's not enough by Barbie standards. So still I'm falling short. Still, it's still my fault. I need to invest more energy. I need to invest more time into my appearance or how I show up in the world. And that's where all this internal dialogue comes in, I think, is like, how can I second guess myself in this situation and what could I do better?
Yeah. I'm these are conversations straight out of like therapy sessions I've had with several women this week, just like that struggle. I'm not enough. I don't feel good enough. I've been told I'm not good enough. And just the shame that it creates, the low self-esteem that it creates. And yet it doesn't matter how you feel. You still have to present yourself a certain way in the minds. And this movie does such a good job of that. I wanted to shift gears in body image for a second before moving on to one more theme and talking about the characters of Ken and Barbie for a second. So one of the things I found really interesting, and I wanted to ask you about this because we've done it on this podcast, and I think it's really funny, but like, this movie highlights how hurtful it can be that men objectify women, right? They see them as objects. But why? It's funny to me that I find it humorous when women objectify men, right? I think it's hilarious. But it's also such a big discrepancy because it feels awkward and uncomfortable. And sometimes like Barbie calls it in the movie, like, oh, I feel violence from them, right? What do you think is some of the reasons why it can feel playful and fun when a woman kind of catcalls a guy or like objectifies a man, but why it can feel so damaging or distressing when a man does that to a woman?
I feel like I can answer that pretty easily. And that's more of like a power dynamic thing. So like, women just don't have as great a power as men do in making decisions and politics and culture and society historically.
Yeah.
Like, fact. Like, we can talk all day long about how that's changing. But historically, that has been the case. And so when men do that to women, it's very, we're already like on this very unequal playing ground, and it just pushes women further and further into the ground and squashes them. And it makes, it belittles all these other aspects of them. When men are pretty celebrated in our society for all their achievements and all their success and all their wonderful masculinity, not to say that they don't have their own struggles, but like, we give them kudos for so many things. And then, so if they're like, have this whole set of personality and identity outside of their looks, when we're talking about their looks, it's not as much, it's more like playful jabbing than like we're really knocking down a pedestal because they've shown up in all these other areas of how we define success and how they show up in the world.
So you're saying that Robert Pattinson doesn't walk around in shame and feeling discouraged every time you want to whistle at him?
I hope not. I was just, when you talked about, I was like, ooh, I do that to Robert Pattinson sometimes. But
it's funny. Think about the role reversal. If I was just like always on this podcast, be like, I'm trying to think of a character. Like, so my first kind of like celebrity crush when I was younger was, her name was Kathy Ireland. She's a model, but also kind of an actress. I used to love her. I was like 11 or 12, I think, or something like that. So if I was just always like talking about how hot she was, that would get old really quick. And yet, like, I can't get enough of hearing your inner thoughts about Robert Pattinson.
Well, I think too, it's like, I don't know, like, women are taught to be so, like, it's kind of the same thing, like America Ferrera saying, like, you have to like want things and go after them, but also, you know, shy away and be timid. Mm-hmm. And like, it's just like, I don't know. It's kind of different. Like when women are like put themselves out there and are more like expression, you know, outward, external focus about what they want. Not just like saying like desire, like attraction wise, but like, you know, they want a job and they go after it. Like, I think we're starting to celebrate that more, but historically that has not been the case.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I think it's one of those conversations. I think you nailed it with the power thing. Cause like, there's the positional power and then there's the physical power. Like, if a girl is saying things to a guy, it's a lot less common for the guy to have their safety feel threatened.
Yes, right? Exactly.
I don't, if I'm walking around, like I don't do these, like these social work outings as a male, and almost all of my colleagues and coworkers are all girls. In fact, we recently all went out one time and I found out I was the only guy attending. It was like one of them was getting married and someone literally said, "But Rick, you've got like great feminine energy." I'm like, I don't know what that means. And I'm not sure if I should be like complimented or insulted. I'm just going to still show up and I'm going to have like a pop and I'm going to eat some pizza and I'm going to talk. But I don't know what that means exactly. Right. But I don't feel physically unsafe when I'm in that environment. Right. Especially mm-hmm. if like there's people that have been having drinks and stuff. Right. But if I'm a girl and I'm in an all guy environment and people are drinking, I'm much more likely to feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the
I think safety and power is what it chalks down to, of like, those are very different levels of threat to mm-hmm. a man versus a woman when they're objectified.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just from a time sake, there's so much more I want to talk about in this film. But gosh, it's so many. I mean, you could do like a 10-hour podcast on this and a lot of people have covered mm-hmm. a lot of things. One of the things that struck me about this was like looking at like this shift from like dependence to independence. So like you see early on, like Barbie's in control. It's Barbie's world. And then she goes to the real world and all of a sudden women don't have the power and she feels very insecure and there's all this stuff that's happening. And there's this power struggle in Barbie land between Ken and Barbie. And it's like, okay, Ken is very dependent on Barbie. In fact, it was fascinating. Like I remember feeling like really uncomfortable with the Ken character at first. And then mm-hmm. I think I realized like I'm supposed to feel that way because it's flipping the gender roles. Like in Barbie land, Ken is what the average woman is like often in the real world and kind of being mm-hmm. demeaned. Like he can't participate and he's only there for his looks and, you know, all these other things.
And everything he's doing is for mm-hmm. Barbie's eye, to catch her
yes,
eye.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And like she's perfectly content being just herself and he mm-hmm. can't function without her. And I was like, mm-hmm. wow, I think I'm supposed to feel this way. It's supposed to give me insight into what potentially it's like to be in a man's world as a female. So I was like, all right, they did their job, even though it was like I didn't understand what they were shooting for when I first watched that. But I was just thinking about if our goal is as men and women is to become dependent or independent, I should say, then ends up drawing these hard lines where we might as well build separate civilizations from each other, you know, because it's like at the end of the day, we need each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they do a pretty good job of highlighting that, even though it's still slanted towards Barbie has her world again. And we don't know exactly where Ken lives or if he even has housing over his head and those kinds of things. But you see her own it at the end of the movie. Like, I'm sorry for the way I made you feel, and trying to meet mm-hmm. in that middle ground. And Ken's trying to still figure out, like, I don't know what Ken's arc is in this movie. I don't even know if there is really a full arc, but you see like this, we need each other kind of thing. And so I don't know, like, it feels like, from my perspective, one of the struggles in pursuing independence is that we overlook interdependence. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. Yeah. And I think that's like, I mean, I see it like when I work with couples too, of like, they're like, it has so much to do, like there's like communication and interaction and like time spent and how you communicate love and affection and all these, like, there's just so much wrapped up in it that it's like, I wish you would talk more about like kind of like masculine and feminine energy mm-hmm. instead of like if you're male or female, because like a lot of women have a lot more masculine mm-hmm. energy, meaning like they prefer direct communication. They like to be told what to do in a linear fashion. And some men have more passive communication, things like that mm-hmm. of like, if we can find ways to bridge those gaps and understand that we need that complementary nature, and not just saying heterosexual wise, I'm saying, like, yeah. That's why I like to focus on more of like the energy at play, like dynamic. But like, how do we make those exist? Like for roles in our society and like leadership positions of, I'm just sick of the, like, we shove them in a box because she's a woman, like mm-hmm. in the boardroom, like it's like a very visual representation, instead of like, let's look at some of these women and do they have like markings for leadership, like energy, like for success, like do they have more of that like self-starter, you know, motivational kind of sense to them? Like maybe they should be in the boardroom and be making decisions, and some of these men might be right. better off served like in another role, just like naturally, instead of, oh, they're a man, so I'm going to put them in this role, and oh, they're a woman, so I'm going to put them in this role.
Yeah, just once in my life, even though it would be a terrible choice, I want someone to just go, Rick, we want you barefoot in the kitchen. Now, I'm not skilled in the kitchen, but I just think it would be funny if someone said that. Get in the kitchen. Yeah. Okay, go make me a sandwich. Yeah. That would get old very quick. But it would be funny if that was like, that would be interesting. Kayla, I have an idea for this podcast. And I think, you know, because these are all serious issues. And I think we have an easy solution. And we're going to call this the new segment of, we're going to solve sexism. And we have a 5-minute bit to do it. Do you think we can do it in 5 minutes?
I think we can do it in less than 5 minutes.
Perfect. You know, I was thinking about the America Ferrera. Is that last name? In the speech. And I was like, there's only one movie that has had maybe a speech in it that's more impactful and more long lasting than that one. And I think it's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Today, we celebrate our Independence Day.
I wonder, could you have inserted her as the president of the United States in the movie Independence Day? And maybe she could have riled up the troops and led us to conquer the aliens.
I think that would take a lot of cultural conditioning and some social changing of roles and gender and communication, but I would love it.
Yeah.
I would love to see that.
So here's how we solve sexism. It's very, very simple. It's very a five-step process.
Your 2-5-step process.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And I'm going to mansplain it to everybody.
Please.
No, I just thought that even in this, in hearing you talk about the same things, it's creating empathy in my heart because I'm seeking to understand something that I don't understand. And empathy and seeking to understand always requires a lot of humility. But I just thought that maybe we could do something that our listeners could also do at home, which is just like get inside the mind and the experiences of someone who's different from you and seek to understand their experiences and not to judge them and to interpret them, but just to experience and feel them. So I just thought like, I was asking you a couple questions and I didn't even prepare answers. Maybe I should have had, but I just wanted to ask you like, what is something that you love about being a woman?
I do. I mean, even though it can become exhausting, I like the emotional attunement. Like, I do like the nurturing aspect of, like, my femininity. Like, today, for example, like, we're entering October, spooky season, and I love Halloween. And so I made all of my staff, like, little basket, like, little care baskets of, like, candy and, like, cute little things. And, like, I like caretaking for people, personally.
Yeah, that's a great one. And do you ever feel bad about that at all?
Not bad on the surface, but like, I think it bumps up against other aspects of like, for example, like being in like a leadership position where you have to make decisions and potentially hire and fire and, reprimand people and things like that. It kind of like goes against that nature a little bit. But I also think I have a lot of leadership qualities as well that don't lend itself to womanhood as much. So, yeah. It's kind of like a constant interplay of dynamics. So it's not always easy, but I like the complexity of it.
I like that. I was thinking about this for myself. And so something I love about being a man, one of the things I do love is this, like this inherent, like feeling of responsibility for other people, like this protective nature. Like, I mean, I've got health issues, I got all these things, but yet at the end of the day, I'll still step in front of someone else. I'll still make sure that I'm the one in between them. And like, if we're walking down the sidewalk, that I'm in between the car and the street. Like if I'm walking somewhere with my wife and son, I'll go first. So if a car hits us, it's hitting me first and I'm absorbing it. Like I just do it. And I just instinctively like feel like part of my duty as a man is to protect. And I'm limited in some of those capabilities compared to where I was 10 years ago in physical health and stuff, but I still think that way. And I love that, even though it's a scary responsibility. It's a hard responsibility. And I feel like, you know, like one day, it was maybe a couple months ago. Someone knocked at our door. It was a Friday night, like 11:30 at night. And we're in bed and someone's pounding on our front door. And I'm like, what the heck? And innately I just jump up and I'm first like, where's my family? And is everyone safe? Okay. I'll go answer the door. I'm not even thinking about anything else other than like, I don't want my family near the door. And so I love that. It turns out it was DTE coming to like, hey, you submitted a thing online like 6 weeks ago about a power line. I'm like, and you're coming now at 11:30 on a Friday night. Thanks for being so quick on the response time. Yeah. But like, I didn't know what was going on. My adrenaline's pumping and I'm rising to the occasion. I'm like, I don't know who's at my door. I don't know why they're pounding on my door, but it's my job as a man to go make sure that my family is safe. Like I just, we didn't have to have a family discussion about it. It's just, that's just part of my job as being a man. And it doesn't mean that, I mean, truthfully, my wife is probably more physically capable of defending us right now based on my heart condition and everything like that. But it doesn't matter. It's my responsibility. And she loves that I do that. And I feel like a sense of pride in that. So that's something I do love about being a man, even though it's not a strategy that we've discussed. It just feels like it's just something I'm supposed to do.
Do you feel like that protective nature hinders or helps your role as a therapist?
Oh, that is tricky. I would say that my default tendency, it actually hinders it, because along with that is that kind of the gender stereotypical desire to fix the problems instead of sit with them and care for them. And so I've had to work really hard to overcome being a fixer and we'll just do it this way. Right. Someone just shared a clip with me. It's from a TV show from years ago, the Bob Newhart show, and he's a therapist and he has this like proven strategy that only takes 5 minutes. And the woman will share all the problems. He just goes, okay, here's what I say. Just stop it. And he just starts yelling at people. I was like, I've felt like that before. So it is in my DNA to be a fixer and a protector. So I've had to work to overcome that to be a caregiver and a support person and an empowerer versus me solving the problems.
I feel like I've always had that conversation with heterosexual couples about, like, one of them is the fixer and one of them is the like, no, I just want to tell you about my day so you can empathize and share in this. And they'll be like, well, why didn't you just ask him for this or like whatever? And it's like, no, like I can solve it on my own. Like I didn't need an answer. I just wanted you to feel how I'm feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And I think as I've learned how to do that more effectively, it's transformed me professionally as a therapist, as a leader, and all of those things where, you know, and then I can ask permission to be practical in sessions and they like that. And we'll kind of, well, the visualizations will break it down into charts on a big whiteboard, which they're like, oh, this is interesting. I'm like, I don't know. This is what I like doing, but I can do it with care and empathy and meeting them where that and just helping them visualize what they're saying to me versus me solving it for them. So we've talked about this a little bit, but is there anything that we haven't covered that's really hard about being a woman that listeners should really know, maybe especially who are not females?
So we've talked about unrealistic standards. We've talked about internal dialogue, comparison. I mean, that kind of goes along with like the idealization and expectations and all that, but just the, even if you are quote unquote good enough, like the goalpost is always going to move. And I think, social media is a really big aspect. Like I'm a weird millennial. I do have social media, but I try to be really restrictive about it because I think it's so harmful to people in general, like from an anxiety, depression, mental health standpoint, but also for comparison for all genders and all people, but especially for young girls and women, because it's just, there's always this idealized beauty and parenting and idealized success. And we're just seeing, I would just want to remind people, you're seeing this very manicured lens through which this person is living their life. It is not reality at all. And I think we forget that sometimes because it seems really, it's like living in Barbie Dreamland a little bit, like to go there with them and see this. But again, it's just dreamland at the end of the day. Like it's not reality.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was going to actually say a very similar answer, comparison for what's hard about being a guy. It's just, we compare different things. But there's always this, where do I measure up? Where do I fit in? This hierarchy or patriarchy even, you know, of where we fit in. And, you know, and it's usually defined about it's what we do. It's not always about who we are, because a lot of men hide their insecurities behind how they perform. But, you know, oh, well, you only do that, or you only make that much money, or you only have that kind of car. You can only help your family get this kind of house. You know, and those kinds of pressures of comparison. And as a guy who is in a field that's very traditionally non-male, both not just in therapy, but in grief specifically. And as a guy who's more emotional than the average guys who got like picked on, like quit being so emotional, be a dude. You know, it's one of those weird things of like, where do I fit in when everyone's talking shop? Like when I would go to my wife's events and talk to the other guys that are engineers and, you know, all these things, and they're talking about cars and they're talking about all these things. And I'm going like, oh, okay. You know, and like, what do you do for a living? Well, I help people cry. Like, okay, I'm gonna leave the grief weirdo alone, and we're gonna go talk shop back over here. I always felt like an outcast on a lot of those things. And so I think the comparison, no matter what field someone works in, there's always this feeling of, where do I measure up, and do I have what it takes? And you don't always, based on your own, you know, kind of emotional health, mental health, feel like you have a positive answer to that question. And so you seek to find it in comparing yourself to other people. And so helping, you know, part of my big growth journey as an individual is helping to not need external stimulus to answer that question, but having it be based on who I am and internal and those things has been growth. And so I've tried to help other people along those things, but the majority of my clients are females though, which is to me awesome. And also sad, because I wish in the field that I work in, grief and loss, I wish more men would reach out for help, and they don't. And I think a lot of it is because there's that fear of, you know, not feeling how you measure up.
And I think that's worth reminding people. Just, I mean, I haven't checked on the statistic for a while, but I know, like, as of last year, when I last checked on it, like, the highest suicide rate is amongst middle-aged white men.
Yeah.
Like, it is not, I mean, obviously every walk of life needs mental health help. And that's not to just like put a certain demographic into a box, but I think we forget, like, men's mental health is really important because we need to talk about these things.
And that's kind of a crazy thing, and especially talking about this movie, is that the demographic that has the most power and has the most kind of influence societally overall is also the one that's most at risk for suicide based on all these different other factors too. And so I think it's a check-in of, like, we all have value, we all have purpose, and we need to be interdependent and focus on equality. And also embrace our differences and embrace the unique strengths that we may have, whether it's specifically tied to a gender or, like you said, I love how you phrase it, like a gender energy or a gender trait that whether the man or the woman or anybody has, those traits need to be celebrated. And I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. Before we wrap up, I wanted to do just a couple minutes talking about the two primary characters in this film, Barbie and Ken. So when you're thinking about, like, Barbie, she's going through an existential crisis. She has this crazy emotional breakdown, realizes the reality she's been living is not real, and she doesn't know who she is or what reality is anymore. Like, I mean, this is a loaded question, but, like, if you're working with someone like that, Barbie walks into your door. We'll talk about the Margot Robbie version of your door. Like, what's a question that you'd ask her? And, like, how would you approach, like, beginning the helping journey with her?
Yeah, I think, like, the overview of her is she's on this journey of discovering what it means to be a real woman. And she doesn't know what that means yet because she's had this idea of, like, this is a woman. And then she goes to the real world and she's like, all these women are unhappy. They're on the other side of things. Like, what is this? And she's kind of somewhere in between. Like, there are parts of herself that she doesn't want to leave behind and parts that she definitely wants to leave behind. But I think for her, the biggest thing is, like, so much of her life has been defined, like, opposite of what you're saying, by external stimuli and external circumstances. Mm-hmm. She's been told who she is and the box she needs to fit in and the clothes she needs to wear and the way she needs to act and the way to do her makeup and all these things that if we strip away all that stuff, like, just getting her in touch with her intuitive nature and saying, you know, what's the last thing you did for you? Like, do you ever spend your time doing something where time just flies by? Like, what are those things that, like, we can really get you back to that authentic nature or start to try different things or things that you've never done even? And, like, how do we go about cultivating, like, actual, I know she doesn't really go by Barbie anymore at the end, but, like, whoever Barbara. You want to be. Barbara. Yeah.
That was a great, funny joke to end the movie on, of, like, I'm going to see my gynecologist. That was great. Well played. That's great insight, is, like, helping her realize who she is now and everyone else wants her to be, and all these things that she's tried to conform to, and her real identity as a person is huge. And, like, almost to the point where it's a joke, we talk about identity in every episode, but it's like, it is the foundational element of who we are. And when that's disrupted and we don't know who we are, whether it's an emotional crisis or it's an environmental situation that's changed and it disrupts our identity, man, it's like really, really, can be really traumatic to us. And so I think helping reestablish who she is and recognize that is powerful. All right. So Ken is Ken.
He is Kenuff.
So I was thinking about this, and I typically don't throw out diagnoses, but I'm studying for my licensing exam right now. And so I wanted to throw out something to see what you thought about it. Cause, like, Ken's entire world in this movie revolves around Barbie. Like, he's not enough without her, and without her approval and love and support, he feels like he's nothing. And when his earth is kind of shattered, he discovers this whole other world of patriarchy. Now he knows, okay, I'm going to go to the opposite extreme. I'm going to find and create this new power structure to be independent of Barbie's kind of need. But he goes to the opposite extreme of kind of power abuse and stuff. But the version of Ken we see early on, how would you feel about the diagnosis of dependent personality disorder.
It's kind of where I thought you were going. That makes sense. Like, I can't be happy. I can't live a full life unless this person is acknowledging me or we are connected in this way.
Yeah. I mean, I was looking through the diagnostics. And so for those who don't read this stuff, like us,
just leisurely,
yeah, just leisurely, casually looking through diagnostic codes. So here's a couple of the traits that would make someone qualify for this diagnosis. And again, diagnosis isn't our identity, but it's helping us in formulating treatment plans and stuff. So here's a couple of things that struck me in the definition: excessive need to be taken care of. Like, he has that crazy surfing injury at the beginning, and he's just like feigning over Barbie, please take care of me. And he's like leaning on her for physical support, even. Clinging behavior. He was very clingy to her, and he goes in for that kiss and she doesn't return it, and he's just standing there waiting and doesn't know what to do, and she finally says, okay, you can go now. Fear of separation, you know, until she finally goes, go find, you know, out in the real world, she tells him to go. Other than that, he's always needing to be right by her side. Strong doubt of their own abilities and skills. You see that in this film. Mm-hmm. And then cultivated helplessness. There's parts of this movie until he starts to go to the extreme level of I'm kind of helpless in who I am. And then he wants to ride horses after that. But so I don't know, when I was reading that, I was like, I feel like that's actually a fairly appropriate match for Ken in this movie. Do you agree?
Yeah. Yeah. I think he would require a lot of attachment. And then our word of the day, identity work also.
Yeah.
Like, learning, they both need identity work of who are you outside of this world, this existence that you've always known.
Right. I thought about, like, here's how I would help him, but the movie, I think, already does an amazing job, and I'm just going to reiterate what the movie does. I'm just kidding, anywhere else I'd be. Just got to express it. Is it my destiny to live? Express your inner dialogue. I was in tears when I saw that movie. I'm just Ken, but he kind of comes to the place that Ken is good enough. Like, you know, yeah. And so I think the movie takes him on this journey of, he goes from one pendulum of complete dependence on Barbie to independence from Barbie. He doesn't need her. We're going to create this power struggle. And then finally starting to kind of veer back into this interdependence of, we need each other kind of journey. But I think for him, helping him grow, like, his strengths, recognize what he's able to do in a healthy way versus the abusive way that he kind of follows in this film, to recognize that he's still can have interdependence, but he's capable of making decisions, capable of loving himself, and doesn't need to solely meet that need through external people and situations like that. So he kind of does go on a little bit of an arc, even though he definitely takes it to the extreme, which is what makes the comedy of this movie so amazing.
I'll play the guitar at you.
Oh, yay!
Oh, so good.
At you.
I love it. That's the key. I'll play the guitar at you. Well, I will. Oh, my gosh. Kayla.
That's how you should start every podcast now, Rick. I'm going to talk at you for an hour.
Sublime!
Tune in, guys. What if I just did it in therapy? I'm going to talk at you for 1 hour, and then we'll bill it to insurance afterwards.
I think clients love that.
So good. Kayla, this was fun. I learned a lot. Thank you for sharing from, like, your real world experiences for me. I hope that listeners found it just as, you know, valuable and insightful. And ultimately, you know, I think we solved sexism in 4 minutes today. We didn't take the full 5 minutes. I think so. But my goal, and if you're listening to this, have empathy for other people. Seek to understand their experiences. Seek to understand their struggles. Whether we're talking about gender, whether we're talking about race, ethnicity, cultures, learn from other people. Build empathy, because that's how this world heals. That's how this world changes. And it also changes and heals from Ken and Barbie. I think, maybe. I might have got that one wrong. What do you think, Kayla?
I think this movie was incredibly healing. I know I cried a few times.
I loved it. I cried. I laughed. I had my mind kind of open to some things. I loved it. So with that, we will see you next time on Cinema Sessions.
Sublime! Sublime!
We need that good feminine energy.
All right, let me just hit stop here.